We're starting at 10 promptly. It's now 10 o'clock. If everybody could please find your seats. And welcome. If anybody has neglected to turn off your cell phone, now's the time to do it. And without further ado, I'll introduce Dina Zimmerman. This is Dr. Dina Zimmerman. She is a friend and colleague from Israel. She was one of the first women to be certified as a Yoetzet Halacha, an advisor to other women in the areas of Taharat HaMishpacha, the laws of Mikvah, and women's health. Just between you and me, the reason why Dina is one of the first is because Dina never, ever asked for an extension the whole time that we were in the program together. And therefore, she was certified after exactly 2 years, and she's been a wonderful Yoetzet Halacha. She's also a physician. The lifelong love of Jewish studies. She graduated from Yale undergrad. She went to Albert Einstein College of Medicine. She's been on the faculty at Rutgers at the University of Medicine and Dentistry. And since she's completed her studies at Nishmat, she has written a book about Taharat HaMishpacha and women's health. She and her chavruta also wrote the first article by women to appear in the prestigious Israeli halachic journal Tchumin. And Dina's been serving as a medical advisor to the Nishmat Women's Halachic Hotline, which was established a year ago and has already received over 5,000 queries from women all over the world. Building on the information accrued from questions on the hotline, Dina's just developed the Nishmat Women's Online Information Center, which is a website dedicated to women's health and halacha, www.yoatzot.org. Dr. Zimmerman lives in Nof Ayalon in Israel with her husband, Rabbi Sammy Zimmerman, and her children, Ari, Akiva, Yosef, Rivka, and Tikva. Tikva's around here somewhere. And in addition to being a Yoetzet Halacha and writing a website, she's also a practicing pediatrician and a lactation consultant. So without further ado, Dina Zimmerman.
Okay, I guess I have to be very grateful that we're really keeping to the schedule this morning, because the title of the talk that I was giving is pretty daunting in terms of how much time it could conceivably take to get through all those topics. I do, however, want to start for a moment at the end of the title, which is in Jewish law, and point out the word in. This indicates that we're going to be discussing the principles relating to the many topics in the title in Jewish law, and not the rule for any particular case. As halacha, okay, Jewish law, is case-based. I'll also point out that this is, as I said, a tremendous amount of material to cover. I am trying primarily to work on the principles here, and there are principles that unite all the different parts of what we'll be discussing, and I'm going to leave time for questions at the end. That said, it's very appropriate that we are discussing this topic between Parshat Noach and Parshat Lech Lecha. In Noach, we find twice the statement, "Pru urvu, be fruitful and multiply." The first time is in chapter 9, verse 1, "Vayivarech Elokim et Noach ve'panav v'yomer lahem pru urvu melu at haaretz." Be fruitful and multiply and fill up the land. The second is in the same chapter, verse 8, Ve'atem pru urvu shirtzu ba'aretz v'ravuba. And you shall be fruitful and multiply, be plentiful as the insects and multiply. Rashi explains this repetition by stating that the first verse is a blessing and the second is a commandment. He also quotes a midrash that explains the juxtaposition of the second verse with the previous one that was discussing the prohibition of murder by stating, he quotes the midrash that states, he who does not engage in the task of being fruitful and multiplying is similar in some ways to one who murders. What we see from this and many, many other sources is the importance of trying to have children. And we see that in Judaism, we really do not have the concept that was very popular when I was growing up. I think it's getting a little bit out of vogue nowadays, but the population of zero population growth. This commandment of pru urvu does, however, have its parameters. as laid out in the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law. The first chapter of Evan HaEvzer is dedicated to this mitzvah. The three most salient points for our discussion are as follows. Number one, there is a biblical commandment that is fulfilled when one has had two children, a boy and a girl, who themselves have reproduced. Two, there's a rabbinic commandment that mandates continuing to try to have children as long as one is able. Three, the commandment of pruravu applies to men and not to women. However, the last point is technically true, but practically, nowadays, when a man is only entitled to have one wife at any particular time, one's wife is a key player in a man's ability to fulfill his commandments, so sort of through the back door, women end up being obligated as well. This last point, however, that the commandment applies to men as well as to women, is also important in sort of our discussion of some of the different methods, as we'll see later on.
Let's save the questions for the end.
Yeah, please write it down, because otherwise I'm just afraid we're not going to get through everything and we'll go off on sidetrack. Another background issue to understand is the prohibition of the destruction of male reproductive organs, known as sirus. This is based on a verse in Leviticus 22:24. One cannot bring a sacrifice of an animal whose genitalia have been damaged, nor can one inflict such damage. This is brought down, this is codified in law in the Shulchan Aruch. Asur lafsid evrei hazera ben be'adam uben be'behema chaya ve'of echad tmeim ve'echad tehorim ben be'eretz Yisrael ben v'chutz la'aretz ve'amisareset ha'nekeva ben be'adam ben be'shar minim patur aval asur. The destruction of the male reproductive organs in men, animals, or birds of any kind in any place is forbidden. One who does this to a female does not incur a punishment, but it is nevertheless rabbinically prohibitive. Another key issue to our discussion are the prohibitions against masturbation and hotza'at zera levatala, literally removing seed for naught, and hashchatat zera, which is destruction of seed. I'm being a bit vague as to these concepts, not only as a matter of modesty, because there is a lot of debate as to what their exact definitions and their parameters are. And if we were to concentrate on that, we would be using up most of the time they are allotted. It is very important to point them out, however, as they will come up many times in our discussion. The last background principle is the concept of taharat mishpacha, the laws of family purity, which prohibit physical contact between husband and wife at the time that a wife is nidah. While the nidah status is most commonly entered by menstruation, it is not synonymous with menstruation, and it can also be entered by other forms of uterine bleeding that are not caused by trauma, such as that caused by hormonal manipulation, a very important thing when we're discussing various birth control methods, and also by medical procedures that lead to an opening of the uterus beyond a certain minimum. With all this background material, let us now try to attack the main topics. Number one, birth control. This can really be divided into a number of sub-questions. The first one is birth control ever permitted? And the second is, assuming that it is, or when it is, what methods are preferable? As we have seen, one is always supposed to be involved with having children. And I think the words that they use, la'asok b'priya u'riviya, to be involved in it, are not chosen lightly. Okay? It's interesting because that same idea of la'asok is what we say every morning in la'asok b'divrei Torah, that all our actions every single day should be infused with Torah. Even if it's something plain and simple, we have to keep Torah in mind, and I think that's somewhat the same idea that's involved in this La'asok b'priyah riviyah. There are times, however, when other factors in halacha, such as concern for the couple's physical or emotional or psychological health, outweighs this commandment, and contraception would be permitted. Furthermore, if the couple has already fulfilled the biblical commandment of having a boy and a girl, and we are now dealing with the rabbinic commandment to continue to having children, it's a little bit easier to find leniency when one is dealing with a rabbinic commandment than one is dealing with a biblical commandment. As this question, is birth control permitted, is a case-by-case decision that needs to be made weighing all these various factors and should be done with the individual couple in concert with the Rav, I'm not going to get into it further at this point, other than just to point out that the concept does exist and there are times that it can and in fact even should be used. That being given, what methods are preferable? The ideal method would be temporary, and thus we would have no concerns about sirus or sterilization. And it should not interfere with marital relations in any way, and therefore not raise problems of hotza'at zera levatala. And it should also cause no medical or halacha complications. Of the actual methods that are available, okay, the one that comes closest to this ideal are the oral contraceptive pills. And thus, this, or what's colloquially often referred to as the pill, even though at this point already we're up to at least 30 different forms and about 50 different brand names of them, so calling it the pill is a little bit funny. But this is generally the method of first halachic choice. There is, however, another principle of Jewish law that always has to be brought into play, and that is that we are not entitled to risk our health. As the medical literature waxes and wanes as to the risks and benefits and the desirability of this method, so too will the halachic literature often wax and wane as to its desirability. And furthermore, there certainly are some women for whom there are medical contraindications to using hormonal manipulation. And for them, it would not be an option. An additional problem with hormonal contraceptives, however, is that in some women, it can disturb their menstrual cycle in such a way that they will always be nida. Well, that would make the method 100% effective. It does not lead to much peace in the house, which is another halachic principle, okay, the idea of shalom bayit. And therefore, in those situations, we would start having to look for something else. The longer-acting methods of hormonal contraceptives, things such as Depo-Provera, which is an injectable form of progesterone that is basically a shot or injection that's given four times a year, or Norplant, which are these little capsules that contain forms of progesterone that go under the skin and let the hormone come out over time, are more problematic in this regard, because if a woman is having a problem, if she's having a problem taking an oral contraceptive pill, so she stops taking the pill and within about a month or so, her body will probably come back to more or less normal. If she has injected the Depo-Provera, it's going to be at least 3 months before there's anything you can do about it, and the Norplant's even longer unless you take it out, which is another thing. So there certainly is an advantage to thinking of shorter acting longer than longer acting when you're dealing in a halachic context. A less known method in the U.S., and I'm guessing in Canada as well, although please forgive my American provincialism, it's not true, is the intrauterine device. This is a reversible. The couple is unaware of its presence, and thus it might seem almost ideal. Okay, it's basically a little piece of metal, usually copper, various forms, sometimes coated with plastic, that's injected into the uterus, and for reasons that till this day we don't totally understand, seems to prevent women from getting pregnant. However, there are a number of problems with this method. The first of them is, as we mentioned, we don't really know exactly why it works. There are two theories, one of which is that it interferes with implantation. In other words, the egg and the sperm meet. You have an ovum, but when the ovum gets to the uterus, somehow that piece of metal makes a difference in the uterus, and the ovum, the zygote, cannot implant, and therefore no viable pregnancy results. The other method, the other presumed explanation of why it works is that in some manner it actually interferes with the conception itself. It interferes with the sperm uniting with the egg. Now, if we go by the first explanation of implantation, people have raised the halachic problem that perhaps this might be a form of abortion, okay? Because you actually have conception taking place, but not, and then it's interfered with. Perhaps that is a form of abortion. The feeling in the medical literature nowadays is that the vast majority of the success of this method, somewhere in the range of 99% of the cases, were actually dealing with interference with the conception, and the idea of implantation is only kind of a backup method. Okay? So the medical literature supports that it's most of the time not a matter of abortion, it's a matter of preventing the conception, but that chashash of abortion, that suspicion of there might be abortion involved here, does lead some rabbanim not to like this method, although there are many, you know, many rabbanim and many sources that do approve of it. The other issue is that there was a case, it's about 25 to 30 years ago, there were a number of cases of actual death in the United States of one particular brand of the intrauterine device, known as the Dacron shield, and it was banned in the U.S. for a number of years. It also, therefore, gave a very bad name to this whole intrauterine device, and in the U.S., less of 1% of women who use contraception use the intrauterine device, despite the fact that worldwide it is the most common form of reversible contraception that is used. Okay? So chances are it's going to be a little bit more common getting to this hemisphere over time. It's certainly very popular in Israel, and in Israel it's very often viewed as the second halachic choice after the pill. I also want to point out that there is a newer form of the intrauterine device, which is progesterone-coated. Its brand name in Israel is Mirena. I don't know if it's available here or it has a name here, but it certainly does exist. And it's being marketed and it's being touted as preventing bleeding, because the progesterone leads to less bleeding, because one of the side effects of the intrauterine device is that women often have very heavy periods and they have bleeding, and this is supposed to cause less. The problem is that when drug companies do studies, they aren't necessarily looking at women who are keeping Taharat HaMishpacha. And while it may cause less bleeding, it can also cause more spotting. And if that spotting decides to come out at the wrong time of the month, like just before you were about to go to the mikveh, it once again can lead to 100% efficacy by keeping the woman in a perpetual state of nida. Next, we come to the barrier methods, such as the diaphragm. Here, you actually have a physical barrier that is preventing the sperm from entering the uterus. And because we have this absolute barrier, perhaps we are now dealing with an issue of hotza'at zera levatala, because the sperm is not getting to where it is supposed to be getting to. Therefore, there are authorities who either totally prohibit the use of this method or restrict it to very unique and special cases. Other authorities feel that since it's indeed inserted so deeply that the couple is usually unaware that it is there, that this is still considered an acceptable placement of semen, and they are more likely to permit this method. The condom is a bigger problem, as it absolutely interferes with the placement of semen, and is a almost, I mean, there's a very important principle in medicine, never say never, okay? So it's true in halacha, never say never, but almost never, okay? Would the condom be considered an acceptable form of birth control? It's used for disease prevention, such as in cases where one of the members of the couple has had a needle stick and we're worried about the possibility of HIV, of AIDS, and we're waiting to get the results, which can take a couple of months, or in cases where the husband is carrying a disease such as hepatitis C or CMV that can be sexually transmitted and we're concerned about its potential effect either on the wife or on the fetus, there may be some more room for leniency, but that's one of the issues, contemporary medical halachic issues. Okay. Sterilization, which is actually the most popular form of contraception worldwide, is the most problematic in halacha. Vasectomy is out. It's exactly the biblical prohibition we mentioned at the outset. I mean, that is serious. Tubal ligation, or tying the tubes on women, is a rabbinic prohibition. Where pregnancy is a matter of life and death for the mother and other methods of contraception will not work, it may be permitted in individual circumstances, but in general, it's forbidden. Now, we'll move to the discussion of infertility. Once again, this is so appropriately placed right before the week of Lech Lecha. Because in Lech Lecha, Hashem comes to Avraham and he says, "Al tira Avraham, shtarcha harbe me'od. Don't worry, Avraham, you're going to have the best, most wonderful rewards in the world. You haven't used up your rewards in the battle that you have, and the best is still to come." Avraham's poignant reply is, "Adoni Hashem, mati ten li va'anochi holei chavivi. What can you possibly give me as I am childless?" This statement echoes in the heart of any couple who has experienced infertility. It's not an uncommon problem, as it affects somewhere between 10 to 20% of couples at some point in their life. Fortunately, there has been much progress in recent years in the treatment of this condition. And there also has been much halachic discussion about the issues raised. To help manage this large topic, let's divide it into diagnosis and treatment. Fertility problems can be due either to the husband, the wife, or both, or as it's often expressed in the medical literature, male factors, female factors, or mixed factors. We love putting things in big words. The estimates are that about 40% of the cases are due to male factors, about 40% are due to female factors, and 20% either to both or of an interaction of both. Thus, the first step generally, if someone would be coming to the doctor to figure out the problem, as it can happen equally in either member of the couple, would be to test both simultaneously. And in the traditional medical approach, that's exactly what's happened. The wife is sent for a series of blood tests and ultrasounds, and the husband is asked to procure a semen sample. From a halachic standpoint, the semen sample leads to facing two issues. One of which, as I mentioned, the prohibition of masturbation, because that is generally how the sample is obtained. And two, the prohibition of hotza'at zera lebatala, or wasting seed, since this sample is going to be used for testing and is not going to be used for attempting to impregnate the wife. For this reason, the halachic approach is generally to test the wife first, at least with non-invasive testing, and then to test the husband. If a cause is not found in testing the wife, then generally the procurement of a sample from the husband is permitted, as the ultimate goal is procreation. So it's not really a hotza'at zera levatala because there is an ultimate purpose here of pur revu. How to obtain the sample needs to be decided on a case-by-case basis with the fertility specialist and the rav working in concert. Treatment, of course, depends on what the underlying cause is, and major advances have been made in the last decade. The general focus nowadays is often on the wonderful new technology, but I want to stay for one second on a perhaps more common problem that often has a more simple solution. And that is the issue of what is often known as halachic infertility or religious infertility. This is a situation where medically there is no problem, okay? The woman is having a cycle, the woman is ovulating, the man has viable semen, and there's no problem in the relationship itself. And medically, there's no reason why they shouldn't get pregnant, except that the woman is ovulating before such time as she can go to the mikveh. And because of her religious needs, she is missing her period of ovulation, and she's missing her period when she can, the period of time, excuse me, when she could be getting pregnant. From the experience that we've been having with the questions that we get at Yoatzot Halacha, we're coming to realize how often this problem is really one of our own making. That far too often women are missing going to the mikveh because they're not going to the mikveh when halachically they absolutely positively could be going to the mikveh if they would simply go and ask the shayla, okay? And I really want to put out a plea to people that the tendency on part of women sometimes who feel uncomfortable asking a shayla because it's embarrassing, I don't want to do it, whatever, I'll just wait another day and be on the safe side. That waiting an extra day and that waiting an extra 2 days can often lead to months and months and even years of infertility. And we just see it over and over again. And I cannot tell you how many couples we have so far helped solve their fertility problem with no hormonal intervention whatsoever by just either helping them ask the shayla or coaxing them through asking it, or intervening and asking it for them, and that really often is the basis. And it's something that women have to know by themselves, because often when they go and speak to a doctor, the doctor doesn't understand the fine nuances of Hilchot Nida. And if the woman says to him, you know, I have my period for 9 days, and therefore I'm not getting to the mikveh until day number 16, he will take that at face value and not know the difference between when she is really having her period and she's anida, and when she's still having some staining afterwards, which, while questionable and needs a question, may in fact be permissible if the question is asked. I have really had women who have been who are about to go through really invasive tests when the problem was that they never asked the shayla. So I can't stress that enough. The advance that has been made in this issue, also of halachic infertility, is now with various forms of hormonal control, we can sometimes trick the body into ovulating a little bit later. And therefore, there are many cases that maybe 30 to 40 years ago would have been very difficult to solve that can be solved easier. Okay? So I had to point that out. The focus often when we're talking about infertility treatment is what's known as the artificial reproductive technology, or ART for short. And it includes a number of techniques which are known by their acronyms, such as IVF, GIFT, ZIFT, ICSI. They seem to like giving them initials. And what they are basically artificial ways of reproducing the steps to get the chromosomal material of the male into the chromosomal material of the female, have conception often outside of the body in a test tube, leading to its popular name of the test tube baby, and then implanting it back into the wife's body to allow for pregnancy, a conception, pregnancy, and hopefully delivery. The difference between the GIFT and the ZIFT and things like that is at what stage, how big is what you are re-implanting into the wife's body, at how many cells, etc. The pace of the development in this field is so fast that the final position of halacha has not been, on many of these things, has not yet been solidified. The same issues, however, are similar to those that were raised by birth control. Number one, to be able to get the genetic material from the husband requires procuring a semen sample. And the problems that I raised before as far as testing apply here to treatment as well. Second of all, will the procedure or the treatment render the wife anida? And that can be problematic too, because if she's undergoing some sort of intervention that makes her anida, so she can't come to the mikveh, and then she can't have relations with her husband when we're not talking about a test tube baby, that can also be a problem. Further issues that are raised by artificial reproductive technology are, who are the father and the mother? And in some cases, such as ovum donation, the jury is really still out on this one. An additional major concern when we are talking about conception outside the body is the possibility of laboratory error. There are enough cases that have already hit the papers about where the samples have been switched either by accident or on purpose, that this is not such a far-fetched possibility. And therefore, there is an emphasis now on trying to provide some sort of halachic supervision when IVF is done. There is an institute in Israel called Machon Pu'ah that actually sends mashkichim into the IVF laboratory. Actually, it sends mashkichot, they're all women, to make sure that everything is sealed and there's no possibility of switching one with the other. And other hospitals do it another way. Shaarei Tzedek Hospital, for example, has its own method of assuring it. And I know that there are efforts underway in certain hospitals in the United States to try to provide this kind of supervision as well. The one issue that, interestingly, is not a problem is whether we have a right to embark on this technology at all. How can we interfere with God's work or God's decree? This is not a Jewish approach, as we believe that Hashem gave us the intelligence to deal with these problems and other problems of the real world. We do, of course, have to be careful with what we do with this gift and this intelligence and this knowledge, and we have to remain humble. Infertility is one area where we see why we need to remain humble. For all the media hype about medical interventions and what we can do nowadays, it doesn't always work. 30% is considered a really good success rate for an IVF lab, which if you look at the flip side, that means we accept about a 70% failure rate. This brings us back to the first words of the title, not all according to plan. While halacha provides for birth control in certain circumstances, as we have seen, and it allows us to take advantage of the newest artificial reproductive technology, we cannot succumb to the prevailing modern trend to feel that we can plan everything. Starting off by saying, I'm going to have a boy and a girl, or this is a true story. I once remembered a nurse in the ICU saying to me, my sister's getting married in April, so I want to be sure to have my baby by December, because that way I'll fit into my clothes by April. And she said that in total seriousness. It's not a Jewish approach. We want to strive for what God has planned for us. Our role is to try, and to even try hard, but remembering that the ultimate control is not ours. This is very well expressed in a verse in Kohelet, chapter 11, verse 6, that is often cited as the proof text for the rabbinic injunction to have many children. Baboker zera etzarecha, ulaerev al tanach yadecha, ke incha yodea eze ikashel, hazeh ozeh ve'im shtehem ke'achad tovim. In the morning sow your seed, and in the evening do not desist, for you do not know which will succeed or whether both will be equally good. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Dina. That was wonderful. We have now a good amount of time for questions. There is a microphone directly in the back of the room, and we'd like all the questions to be into the microphone so that they can be recorded for posterity. So if anybody has a question, those people who have questions would please line up by the microphone and I'm sure Dina will be happy to answer your questions. Of course, please keep your questions short. Please don't make speeches. Try to keep your questions to, I don't know, 15 seconds, and Dina will be happy to answer them. Thanks.
You referred when you were discussing the IUD to some rabbis who are reluctant to recommend it on the basis that it may constitute an abortion if it prevents implantation. But surely the prevention, if it takes place, is within the first day or two after the ovum is formed. How can that constitute an abortion from a halachic point of view?
Okay, because any form of abortion in Jewish law is a problem. When it happens less than 40 days, it's less of a problem. Okay? So you are correct that when we are looking at less than 40 days, we have the concept that it's not really alive yet, that it's mayim ba'alma, it's just water. And that is a principle that certainly can help in cases when there is a need to end the pregnancy, to make it easier to end at an earlier period of time. It's not a blanket thing that anything that happens before 40 days, we don't have to worry about it at all. Okay? So therefore, it is something to think about, to worry about. The fact that it's before 40 days is why those people that permit it are even more willing to permit it, because they say most of the time it's probably preventing contraception. If it's not preventing contraception on a minority of the time, and it is preventing implantation, and this may be part of an abortion, that is also happening before 40 days. So, hope that answers the question.
I just was wondering, you talked about the statistics which said 40% of infertility problems with males, 40% of females, and then there's that 20% in the middle. And then you said because of the halachic prohibition against masturbation, that you generally test the woman first. I was just wondering if you don't end up then sort of leading down the wrong path, because let's say there's a problem, but you have now, but a third of those women are also in a situation where there's also a male problem. So you might be trying to repair the problem or find a solution when you don't have all the facts in front of you. And I'm wondering if halachically that's ever been addressed, in that maybe there is a good reason to test at the same time, because you might end up wasting a good deal of time, you know, trying to follow the wrong path.
Right. Well, I think that when you take the... Well, even if you don't take the gradual approach, in any approach, infertility testing and diagnosis takes time, okay? It usually, you need a couple cycles to see what's going to happen, because even in the most fertile couple, only about 20% of couples will conceive each time that they try. So you have to allow three cycles to just see if things are going to work out. So time is a consideration. It doesn't, in most cases, it would probably not obliterate the other considerations, unless, once again, this is why things are case-based. If you are talking about a couple where the wife is 39, 40, has never had children before, and time is not on your side, there would be reason to work faster than if you're talking about a couple where the wife is 26, 27, you know. So you're raising a good point. It's something that needs to be addressed a priori at the beginning, and I think it's also something that is so important in our counseling of couples, because in addition to the danger that you raised, that you might be wasting time, you also have the possibility of stigmatizing. In other words, if we're going down the path of the woman, we need to make it very clear that we're going down the path of the female factors, not because she's more likely or she's more likely to be at fault, but because halachically those are easier to do, and that's why we're doing it, and it doesn't mean that the problem can't be on the other side. I also mentioned the fact as far as the non-invasive testing, because, and this once again will be individual between Rabbanim, most people would not have a problem saying the wife should first get a blood test and an ultrasound before we go for the semen sample.
it's a matter of debate. Well, do we send her for a hysterosalpingogram, where you actually have to insert a catheter and inject dye, and it's more unpleasant? Do we go for a biopsy, which is even more unpleasant? You know, how far are we going to go down that before we try the other side? So as I've tried to do many times in this talk, I'm raising the issues here. With all the other issues that are involved in a particular case will depend exactly what we do in that case.
In deference to all the physicians here, I just wanted to say that the simple non-invasive methods of what I know of personally as a pharmacist is birth control for a couple of months to regulate the cycle. Many times you see contraception right after that. And after that, Clomid. Yeah. It's the side effects of both are quite minimal in most cases.
Okay. Once again, I think you're talking about in the case of halachic infertility specifically.
Yeah,
okay?
Of course.
If we come up with a situation where you're talking about an anatomic problem, although hormonal manipulation is not going to make
right.
a difference.
Right. No, absolutely.
In the case
yes.
of
ovulation. But many cases. Many
yes, in cases where the problem is missing ovulation, often
right.
one of the things to do is a couple
right.
of months of
yeah.
birth control followed by Clomid, followed or by various forms of estrogen in various forms that can
right.
be delivered. I just want to, this one comes as a woman, take a little bit of issue with the fact with no side effects whatsoever.
No, I didn't say that.
Because,
excuse me.
Okay.
As
or minimal side effects.
As a pharmacist of 30 years,
uh-huh.
everything
had side effects.
There's
right.
not a medication produced, including water,
mm-hmm.
okay, and schnapps, which is a great HS sedative, okay? This has not had a side effect. As 30 years as a pharmacist experience, I'm telling you, there's no thing that does not have a side effect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And in addition to all the side effects that are reported on in the medical literature, there are additional side effects which women often report in terms of what this various form of hormonal manipulation does to them emotionally and psychologically, which has halachic import as well. Okay, it's not often stressed medically, and people say, fine, what's the problem? Low dose estrogen, what's the big deal? For some women, it is a big deal, and that's something that should be remembered.
You sort of alluded to egg donation and kind of...
I'm sorry?
Hi. Egg donation. You
yeah.
kind of said, we haven't even gone there in terms of many halachic questions. It's coming up a little bit more often,
mm-hmm,
I think.
Mm-hmm.
Well, how does halacha view a Jewish couple looking at egg donation from either a Jewish donor or a non-Jewish donor, and is there a difference?
Okay, it is being looked at.
No,
it's being looked at, and it's even being done in practice. Okay, there are definitely cases of omen donation that go in practice. The reason why it is hard for me to get up and say what to do is it's so, you know, one personal, one Rav, and these are the contemporary Ravs, Rabbanim of our generation. And it's moving so fast that it takes a little while before Tshuvot come in print and all that kind of thing that I can't tell you. Because whatever you want to say, there's somebody who will say it. Some say it's permissible, some say it's not. Some say it's better Jewish, some say it's not. Some say the mother is going to be the egg donor. Some say it's going to be the woman who gives birth. Some say that it's going to be both, and the child has two mothers. Okay? So it is... So up there, it's very hard to come out and say what is going to be the halacha or what is going to be the dominant opinion because we don't yet have a dominant opinion. I think what this does, however, very much bring up the issue of Torah Sheba'al Peh and Torah Bichtav. We are so much in the post-printing press age that for us, what has reality is Bichtav. You know, is there an article in it? Is there a tshuva written on it? And we forget that when we're talking about Torah Sheba'al Peh, it's Ba'al Peh, okay? So there's a lot of Ba'al Peh tradition, a lot of it very private, because it's case-based, that's going on there that is not yet fit to print.
It's not exactly a question, but I think that if there are no other specific questions, I was going to suggest that perhaps you could talk a little bit about the Women's Halachic Hotline and your work with it and the website that you're developing and how the Yoatzot, which is a fairly new thing, work with doctors and with Rabbanim, because it's a chance to hear about that.
Okay.
I also wanted to mention that since I work with Nishmat, there is some literature on the Women's Halachic Hotline, and also I do have some cards for doctors about your seminar coming up, and I thought you might want to mention that as well.
Okay. Thank you for that lead-in. She was not planted, I promise. The idea of making, of training Yoatzot Halacha really came out of the type of thing I was describing before, that there are women who are not asking questions because they're embarrassed to ask that question of a male Rav directly. And the feeling was, if you had women to be trained to do it, we could help. When we first started this program, no one had any idea what kind of numbers we're talking about. When we're talking nowadays of a hotline that is getting 100 phone calls per week, we know that there is a real need out there. And there are so many cases where this lack of asking has led to fertility problems, marital problems. The example that I gave you before of missing it, I can count 10 cases I've been involved in personally just off the top of my head. Okay, and I'm not even directly on the hotline anymore. I'm more getting the questions that need some medical stuff and spending my time more on the website. So I'm, without even being at the forefront of the questions, I'm already getting questions in that number. So the fact that there is a need for this kind of thing is so incredibly obvious to me. And I think our role is not only in terms of making women comfortable in terms of asking questions, it's a matter of having them ask the question correctly, have them understand what their question is, and that means both talking with Rabbanim and talking with doctors. Many doctors are not, they think they know Hilchot Nida because they have religious patients and they sort of have this idea that there's a mikveh out there and that women go to the mikveh. But if you don't know the intricacies of it, then you cannot help a woman with her specific problem. And one of my dreams for this website, funding being looked for, is in addition to the part that is meant to be for the general public, which would allow women access to this area of Taharat HaMishpacha, is to have a place on the web where doctors can look up this kind of thing. If you have a physician who knows he's treating religious couples and wants to understand what's going on, there should be an easy place for him to look it up that will take the halachic problems, put it in the medical terminology with which he or she is familiar, and therefore make him able to serve his patients better. I mean, I had a wonderful this is a true example with Alana, of a Kala who came to her who was having a problem that she might turn out to be a need at the time of her wedding. This is something that is often dealt with very easily by a little hormonal manipulation. She went to her doctor, and her doctor said, there's no way that I'm giving you the pill for this kind of taboo. Now, I am sure if that same doctor would be hearing the same sort of thing about Hilchot Nida from a doctor in medical terminology, and even better in writing, because in medicine it's Torah Shebichtav, not Torah Shebaalpeh, it would make all the difference into the world, and there would be one more doctor that would be out there to help not only one more woman, but lots of other women. So I really think there's a need for that. And also to have a place on this website for Rabbanim to be able to have the newest medical technology that wasn't around when they got smicha put into the halachic terminology that one needs to be able to paskin on it.
Thank you very much for your talk. It's a wonderful talk. It was a wonderful talk, and you are a wonderful argument for yeshivot for women.
Thank you.
Now, on your last point, there is a side effect with the pill which can result in permanent infertility. And there are many cases. It hasn't really been explored properly because at the point where people have been busy taking the pill for many years, they're not really interested in getting pregnant after they get off the pill. They may have other reasons they're off the pill. So really, it hasn't been documented, but it's a fact that if you take the pill for a trivial thing like your wedding date, there is a very significant risk. So I take issue with you about that. Not so simple.
Okay.
Actually, that advice might be very well taken, not to take the pill, because that risk factor exists.
Like I said, the pluses and minuses of the pill are definitely something that waxes and wanes in the literature over time. And I personally have a very healthy fear and respect for it. I'm not sure I would go quite out as far. To say that there is a risk, everything has a risk. Everything in medicine is a matter of risk versus benefit, and, you know, it would depend. I'd be interested in seeing your literature.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
The risk that somebody, because of an issue of a wedding date, should take a risk on their permanent infertility is wrong. It's halakhically incorrect. Excuse me. Now, except people aren't aware of this fact. As I say, because most of the people have been taking pills for years, and suddenly after they finish taking the pill, never get pregnant again, are very happy.
Mm-hmm.
So no one knows about this problem, really, to a significant amount. Now, the other thing I wanted to mention is that women should be aware of the fact that there is a mitzvah called Sheves. It's based on a pasuk in Yeshaya, and the Sheves Yitzhara, and women, according to Chazal, have a personal responsibility to reproduce themselves. Thank you.
Yeah. Have that pasuk in there as well. But it's interesting because I wonder sometimes whether the fact that there is a absolute mitzvah for men to reproduce and a more questionable one for women to reproduce is not a reflection of the fact that far often women innately want to be doing the pururu, and maybe it's the men that need the push and the women don't. But
like in Egypt.
Yeah. No, you can think of many examples throughout Chazal, throughout it. That yes. www.yoatzot.org.
Okay, I think this will be the last question.
Can you address some of the questions around sperm donation in infertile couples?
Sperm donor, in other words, using...
Sperm donor.
Okay. That raises a whole other issue that I didn't get into, which is whether we are talking about would be adultery or not. Okay? There are two kinds of sperm donation, one of which would be by the husband, and the other one would be by a donor. When we're talking about it from the husband, it's less of a problem. It's pretty much the issues that are involved with procuring the sample, and sometimes a matter of when in the cycle you're going to be using it. In other words, is giving a sperm donation with from the husband at a time a woman is nida okay or not okay? There's no relations going on when she's not nida, but on the other hand, is the conception at the time she's in nida problematic or not? When you're talking about donation by a donor, you're faced, we come up again with this idea that the mitzvah of pur revu is a mitzvah for the man. So many of these procedures are permitted because we want a man to be able to fulfill his obligation of pur revu. If you're using sperm only from a donor, you're not taking care of the problem that was allowing us to do a lot of these things in the first place. Now, there are times where you're talking about maybe enhancing the husband's sperm. In other words, he doesn't have enough, so mixing it. So then maybe if it's a chance that it comes from him, maybe it's permissible. But donation from a donor is, it's problematic. Fortunately, it's medically needed to be used less and less because now that they have ICSI, where they, if you can find one sperm in there somewhere, even by testicular biopsy, even if it doesn't come out in semen, and by testicular biopsy you can get one semen, you can then micro-manipulate it, put it in the egg, and do with in vitro fertilization. So.
Dina, thank you so much. This has really been a wonderful talk. On a logistic note, it's now just about 11 a.m. There are three very interesting sessions coming up. Down here will be Rabbi Michael Broidy, talking about bullets that kill on the rebound, discrimination against homosexuals, and Orthodox public policy. At CHET, okay, across the parking lot in room C202 will be Susan.